The list of impeachable offenses that the framers included in the Constitution shows that the essence of an impeachable offense is a president's decision to sacrifice the national interest for his own private ends. Treason, the first thing listed, lay in an individual's giving aid to a foreign enemy. That is, putting a foreign enemy's adversary's interests above the interests of the United States. Bribery occurred when an official solicited, received, or offered a personal favor or benefit to influence official action, risking that he would put his private welfare above the national interest. And high crimes and misdemeanors captured the other ways in which a high official might, as Justice Joseph Story explained, disregard public interests in the discharge of the duties of political office. Based on the evidentiary record before you, what has happened in the case today is something that I do not think we have ever seen before. A president who has doubled down on violating his oath to faithfully execute the laws and to protect and defend the Constitution. The evidence reveals a president who used the powers of his office to demand that a foreign government participate in undermining a competing candidate for the presidency.
It is Friday, September 6, 2019. Welcome to Raging Chicken's Out to Coop podcast. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Each week, I usually talk to our Capitol muckraker-in-chief, Sean Kitchen, about the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics. But Sean, well, unfortunately, he's not here this week. He is on a pre-Christmas adventure on Amtrak. Yes, that's right. America's Railroad, everybody. For decades, Sean has been asking Santa for tickets to ride aboard our beloved national treasure. But each year, he's been disappointed. He's not sure if people thought he was joking or what the deal was, but each year, those tickets never appear. Well, not wanting to be grinched out once again this year, he took matters into his own hands, thumbed his nose at the jolly old elf, yep, and took to the rails all by his grown-up self. Good riding, Sean. Good riding, Sean. We'll see you next week. On this week's show, formal impeachment hearings begin in the House Judiciary Committee on Wednesday. They began, I should say, on Wednesday, with a panel of four constitutional lawyers discussing grounds for impeachment. I gotta say, it was quite a civics lesson. There was like four lawyers. There was three by the Democrats, Noah Feldman from Harvard Law, Pamela Carlin for Stanford Law, and Michael Gerhardt from UNC Law, University of North Carolina. And the one GOP witness that was there was a guy named Jonathan Turley from one of my former places of employment, GW, except he was in GW Law. And Turley, interestingly enough, was the guy who was on the panel before Clinton, when Clinton was getting ready to be impeached, and he was the lawyer brought on to talk about the absolute necessity of impeachment, because if we don't stop it here, you know, lying to Congress about, you know, doing a little shh under the table. Again, it was wrong. I mean, wrong on so many different levels, but he was the one who argued, yes, if you allow this to continue, you allow him to get away with it, then the world, then the presidents from here on out will be allowed to do anything they want. We won't have any checks. But this time he was there to say, like, oh, no, we cannot impeach Trump because people are just mad and people will get madder. So we can't do it. So Clinton messing around with an intern in the Oval Office, again, not saying that's right, but that was like the precipice of disaster, Sodom and Gomorrah kind of level, while as selling out our government, profiting off the office of president, enlisting foreign governments and try to influence our elections, that's fine. That's like child's play. No, you don't need to worry about that. Okay. Well, but yesterday, a very grave House Speaker Nancy Pelosi held a formal press conference to call on all House committees to draft the articles of impeachment. Reports are coming out saying that we might see some articles of impeachment, some votes even, as soon as 2 weeks. Wow. Then the seriousness went out the window when Pelosi was asked a question on her way leaving the dais about whether or not she hated Trump. And that apparently was just too much for her to stand. She walked toward the back to the mics and it's taken all I can stands and I can't stands no more. And she told everybody, put everybody in their place. She said she's a Catholic for Christ's sake. She don't hate nobody. How dare they say she hates somebody? Okay, I guess she can get mad at some things, but whatever. But hey, we're on a roll. As that's going on, well, the UN Climate Change Summit, or aka COP25, is being held in Madrid. That got underway this week, and a new report released by the United Nations Environment Program, that's the UNEP, that was released ahead of the summit, and that showed, well, as we kind of expected, at least we expected here, the world has failed to meet its goals that was set under the Paris Agreement. Now, remember, the U.S. has pulled out of the Paris Agreement, but the rest of the world, too, basically said, okay, our goal is to reduce our emissions. We need to reduce our emissions by 2%. Well, guess what? We saw a 1.5% increase. And the report, look, it's pretty frank. The report says, quote, the summary findings are bleak. Countries collectively failed to stop the growth in global greenhouse gas emissions, meaning that deeper and faster cuts are now required. What does that mean? Well, frankly, we're now on track for a 4 degrees Celsius warming by 2100. Remember, the Paris Agreement said 2 degrees, but then actually revised that downward to say 1.5 degrees because we decided maybe it's not a good idea to allow for the drowning of island nations. So they said 1.5 degrees is where we got to hold it. We are now on track for 4 degrees of warming. That's Celsius. The Paris Agreement called for no more than 2 degrees, as I was saying. And now, basically, emissions must be cut by an average of 7.6% per year beginning in 2020 to stave off the worst impacts of climate disaster. So keep that in mind as you're getting ready to head to the polls in 2020. The latest polling in California now shows that Warren and Biden lost some ground, while Bernie and Buttigieg gained. Bernie is now edging out Warren, like, at the top of the pack at 24% in the polls. Technically, it's a statistical tie with Warren. Bernie has 24, Warren has 22%. Now they are both at the top of the pack. Buttigieg picked up 6 points, and apparently that was at the expense of Biden, who lost 6 points. So, you know, Buttigieg surge is Biden's loss, I guess. You know, so Biden is still edging out Mayor Pete in the biggest delegate-rich state, but that's only 14 to 12%, and just like Biden and Warren, that's within statistical margin of error, so we'll see what happens there. The latest polls have some good news from Bernie, some concerns from Warren, and the sounds of desperation from the Biden camp, and Mayor Pete's little engine that could is still chugging along. We'll give you a little quick rundown when we get into the show. Today's segment two, I'm not going to go do some stuff, the PA stuff today. I'm going to wait for Sean. Sean's got a bunch of stuff, and frankly, there's some things that are just kind of unfolding now, and rather than kind of do it some injustice or to spoil Sean's, you know, or steal his thunder, I guess, for next week, I'm just going to leave that till next week. But what I want to do in segment two today is I want to talk about some new directions for 2020. For Raging Chicken, and particularly this podcast, and I'm going to basically be asking for your help. And don't worry, look, I want you to tune out because I'm not asking just here for you to become a member and all that. You're going to hear that regardless. But we want to changing up some of the format of the podcast a little bit, kind of expanding it a bit, and I want some input from folks, especially people who listen to the podcast, members of Raging Chicken, but also listeners in broad about who we might want to kind of bring on to this podcast. But more on that in segment two. And in today's segment three, today's last call, well, it is a bunch of events at Free Will. We got some releases. I went and I got some Ralphius and some Ella. And, you know, I even got their latest stout. And so I'll have a little update on that. So we'll do that in segment three. Want to remind everybody, tune in to the Rick Smith Show on Free Speech TV this and every Saturday at 7 p.m. Eastern. You can stream the show live at freespeech.org. And tune in to the Dish Network, DirecTV, or through the Free Speech TV app on Roku. Make sure that you're listening to Rick's daily podcast. You can get that on iTunes, Podbean, or wherever you get your podcast. Download that, listen daily, and send Rick some support. And it's a call-in show, folks, so you can call him in. You can give him a piece of your mind, tell him what's going on in your neck of the woods in Pennsylvania, tell him what is happening on the ground of activists, and he'd love to hear from you. That's the Rick Smith Show, daily podcast, iTunes, Podbean, or wherever you get your podcast, and every Saturday at 7 p.m. on Free Speech TV. And you can get that at freespeech.org. And if we want a progressive future, we need progressive media. You can help support Pull No Punches homegrown progressive media today. Become a member for Raging Chicken Press for as little as $5 a month. Simply go to patreon.com/rcpress and choose your membership level. Not ready to become a member? No problem. Just go to ragingchickenpress.org, click on the big blue donate button in the right sidebar. Give us whatever you can. Folks, say Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, and New Year. That's right. But the best way to invest in keeping the media in the movement, and the movement in the media, is become a member for as little as $5 a month by going to patreon.com/rcpress today. Well, everybody, like I said, Sean is riding the rails today, so unfortunately he's not here. I hope you all had an amazing Thanksgiving. I know the holidays can be rough for a lot of folks, the stresses that it brings, and I think that those of you who have families who kind of straddle the political battle lines, I know that they can be stressful at that level too, especially with kind of, you know, emboldened racists and kind of the Trumpistas out there who have decided to abandon the world of facts and kind of, you know, I don't know, justice and caring for anyone else but themselves and their fearless leader. They can be hard to deal with at times. So I hope you made it through all right. Or at least kind of found those moments of solace and reflection and, beer, wine, cocktails as well. I had a great break. If you recall on last week's show, I said that my family and I were going down to Florida. And we did go to Disney and we went to Universal Studios down there. Had a great time. None of us had ever been, right? I've been to Florida a few times, but I've never been to Disney. My wife's never been to Disney. Obviously, my kid's not. We haven't been to any of those amusement parks or anything down there. So this was a first for us. We just had a great time. We kind of went with the attitude of, you know, look, we're both stressed out. We're both worked to the gills. So we're not going to try to schedule everything in. We're just going to take it as it came. And we kind of pretty held true to that. And it was it paid off because we had a relaxing time, a good time. We had some phenomenal food. There's this great place. It's called Cowfish, just so you know. If you ever go down to Universal Studios, there is this restaurant in City Walk, which is kind of like the kind of gated city of Universal Studios, right? So it's not the theme park. You don't have to pay to get in there, but you do have to go through security and go in through a gated system in order to kind of get to it. It's like an outdoor mall gated thing. It's weird. But anyways, there's a place that's called Cowfish. It's a fantastic restaurant. They got sushi and they got burgers and they actually do the sushi burgers. Like you actually have sushi inside burgers. It was crazy. I just had the sushi. But anyways, there's only four restaurants. There's one in Alabama. There's one there. And I guess there's two in North Carolina. But the food was freaking awesome. So if you ever go down there, I highly recommend it, especially if you like sushi. I just like literally had the best sushi I ever had in my life there. And in case my friend Ben is listening, I said, yes, Ben, I know that you've been over in Japan and you could have sushi that's 1,000 times better than anything that I've ever had. But I'm just telling you, everybody out there, for those of you who kind of live a more humble existence than the world traveler that has been, the sushi was just freaking unbelievable. So that's a little tip if you go down there. We spent most of the time in the Harry Potter world. That's in Universal Studios, and that was just fantastic. Maybe I'll talk a little about that more in today's last call. Disney, you know, frankly, personally, I could take it or leave it. I did get to check out the Star Wars stuff. I'll tell you a little about that in today's last call. It was fun. Came back relaxed. And reflected, reconnected with our family. You know, we just kind of spent time together away from, you know, video games and TV and the stress of our daily lives was really nice. But of course, come back, it's the last week of the semester, and all hell broke loose quickly, as it did for my wife's work, and the kids are back to school, so, you know, it doesn't take long to get all stressed out and freaked out all over again. So there you have it. So that's my life, but this world, right, the rest of us, right, had to occupy this political space that is these United States. We saw the launch of the formal impeachment hearings in the House Judiciary Committee this week. On a Wednesday, you had a panel of four constitutional lawyers, and it was basically a long kind of, you know, civics lesson about the history of impeachment, the context for an impeachment, what high crimes and misdemeanors means, why they put this article into the Constitution, and so on. It's kind of like, you know, the kind of the zoom out. Let's put this in perspective. You know, outside of the hand-to-hand combat that is politics these days, let's look at what we're supposed to have when we're, you know, supposed to be doing in a constitutional republic, right? What it is, when we say that we're a democracy, what does that mean specifically, right? What's essential for it? And I got to say is, like, you know, I have a ton of grading to do, and I was grading, but I had the hearings on in the kind of the background. And Pamela Carlin, you heard a little bit of her testimony in today's intro. She's from Stanford School of Law, or Stanford Law. And she started talking about impeachment. I guess Noah Feldman had just finished talking when I tuned in, and then she was talking. And I just got intrigued, you know, just hearing about some of the rationale for why impeachment was put into the Constitution. And you know, I have to say, Rachel Maddow did a good job this week. I think it was Thursday night, maybe. I guess it was Thursday night, last night, where she was, maybe Wednesday night it was, basically going through the histories of impeachments, right, about how they've gone in the past, because there is no one right way of doing this. And I think she rightly pointed out that each of the three impeachment processes that we've undergone in this country, they've all proceeded slightly, you know, differently. President Clinton's, the impeachment of Clinton, was like super fast and like sped along at kind of like high speed. Andrew Johnson's one was kind of, you know, a wholly different process. And some of the things that he was impeached for was, you know, things like being drunk and being a jerk, things like that, not crimes. And then we have this one that's kind of going on right now. So each one has got its own little dynamics to it. They're slightly different. What I found fascinating about her overview of it is she basically talked about this report that was issued ahead of the Nixon impeachments. And most of the impeachments that we're familiar with do something similar to what we saw this past Wednesday, is they've got some constitutional lawyers, although in the past it's been historians, right? Not just lawyers, historians that have given the context, which is weird that was absent from this year, but whatever, to go in the law route, that's fine. And they talked about some of the history. So, I mean, I'm sorry, I was saying, unlike what they did in these ones, in the Nixon impeachment, they kind of were looking around and basically saying, you know, we don't really have a roadmap here for how these are proceeded. So let's go back and look at all the impeachments in U.S. history, not just the presidential stuff, but of judges and other office holders. And so in the Nixon report, they listed all of the past impeachments and what these, you know, public officials were impeached for. And it wasn't just crimes, like, you know, criminal law. And matter of fact, one of the things I found most interesting about the hearings on Wednesday was that, you know, bribery, which is listed in, which is spelled out in the Constitution, right? Treason, bribery, and other high crimes and misdemeanor. Bribery was not even in the criminal code at that point in history, right? So in other words, if somebody was taking bribes, right, that technically would not have been a crime, right? Unless they were in like U.S. Customs Office. It was something really specific in the law at that point. But so in other words, the founders, when they were writing the Constitution, they put in that notion of bribery, understood that the idea of kind of exchanging official acts, like, you know, the quid pro quo stuff, exchanging official acts for personal gain, personal money, getting paid off in order to pass a law or to pass a policy that will benefit from someone, that kind of thing, that was explicitly spelled out there. And it was not technically a crime at the time. Right. So I thought that was kind of fascinating. And I also thought was fascinating when I think it was Feldman who was talking about the definition of high in high crimes and misdemeanors. I had always assumed, and actually Sam Cedar talks about this in the Majority Report on his Wednesday edition too as well. And I was struck by the same thing that he was on what he talked about on the show was my assumption had always been just kind of like, you know, everyday person thinking about high crimes, thinking about high meaning like the most serious, like, you know, if you go up and you kill somebody in cold blood kind of thing, like high crime. Like, but what in actuality, that was a kind of a catch-all term. But what they were referring to when they meant high office, like things that you could only do like from that high position of power, right, from the office of president, which that was fascinating to me. Right. So in other words, like, so those situations which you can use that powerful office in order to benefit yourself, right, that's a high crime, right? A crime that could only be committed by someone who is sitting in that office, right? So that was fascinating to me too as well. And I just dig this kind of stuff. I can geek out on the kind of constitutional history stuff and some of the questions that some of the authors of the Constitution were grappling with when they were trying to think about, well, if we're not going to have a king to kind of center the power, right, to kind of ground the whole system, if we're not going to have a king or queen or some sort of figure there, how do we kind of grapple with this question of power, right? How do we make sure that the person that is elected doesn't use that office as a way to undermine the election process itself to make sure that they continually stay in power, right? And that was kind of essentially what we heard from some of these lawyers, right? And this is where that would have been great to have more historians in on that to talk a little bit about that process and those discussions, because that I just found fascinating. So anyway, so it was kind of like, you know, this moment of pause. And I know Republicans wanted to make this like, you know, into another showboating thing. And I know that Democrats have got their agenda here. But that was a moment, at least for me, is like I thought, you know, this is actually a great public moment, a moment of kind of civic education and kind of in the popular sense. You know, and I hope that took hold for some folks out there and not just, you know, just another kind of bit of theater in the political performance. And of course it's that too, but it's, you know, I found it very, I don't know, grounding in some ways. So that was kind of a really cool part about it. But and so that's basically what we saw in those hearings. The opening up of the hearings was really the kind of let's get our terms right. So we all know what we're talking about here, right? We're not dealing in fantasies and fictions or kind of made up stuff. We're going to deal with what are the meanings of impeachment? What are the conditions that someone or what are the things that people have to do to meet the conditions of impeachment? Stuff like that was really interesting. And of course, in the midst of all that, and I just found this, you know, I just find Nancy Pelosi lately really strange as a political figure. And if you go back on the history of this podcast, you'll hear me kind of defending her as being kind of a really savvy political operative. You know, I've not appreciated her moderation over the years. Whereas, you know, I think that, you know, enough people have said this that I don't need to, you know, make a whole huge case of it. But, you know, she was really kind of rising to power at a time of the Clinton impeachment and coming out of those baby boomers and stuff. And they carry with them a particular kind of perspective and a certain kind of cautiousness, Democratic Party cautiousness, that I just find just kind of repugnant at this point. And so anyways, and so she came out and she made this big formal press conference where she announced that, yes, I'm going to direct the House committees to draft articles of impeachment. And I think, you know, most people who were kind of watching have been like, I thought that's what was happening already here. Why are you doing this? But whatever, she went out and she did that. And so I guess that does mean that we're kind of moving forward. And I guess it is important that the leader of the House Speaker is coming out and doing this precisely because it bumps that the next step right up to the top of the news cycle, makes people pay more attention. A place to focus on this. So that's happening. The part that I found kind of just weird about the whole thing is that I believe it was Jake Tapper, but it might not have been. But so she's like walking off. She gives her announcement. She's walking off the dais, and Jake Tapper or a journalist is sitting there in the audience and ask her that, you know, some people are saying she's impeaching because they don't like Trump. She hates Trump. Is that true? Right? Which is a freaking ridiculous question to begin with, but I guess it baited her enough where he got his answer. So she turns around and starts like berating him, right? So she's the seriousness and graveness of impeachment up there, and then she just like gets pissed off. And she gets pissed off not because this journalist is kind of like just picking up Republican talking points. She says she's like personally offended because she's a Catholic and she was raised never to hate anybody. She doesn't hate the president. She prays for him. And she doesn't hate anybody in the whole wide world because she's a Catholic, right? And I'm like, number one, like, can we just pause for a second and say Catholic and the Crusades? Can we talk about that for a second? Not exactly kind of like a war of love. Okay, can I just say that, right? So just pairing those things as someone who grew up Catholic myself, right, and being around like lots of hating Catholics, right, especially with the rise of the kind of like, you know, the right wing in Catholicism and all that. I mean, so what those two things have to do, I think it was just a weird thing. I mean, I don't know, maybe she's like, I don't know, found God all over again and now, you know, has had personal conversations with Jesus just like the rest of the Republicans. That's why this is so important to her. But I don't know. But who knows? It happens to folks as they get older, I guess, whatever. But it was just very strange to see her get pissed off, that pissed off, because she was accused of hating someone. And look, if you're going to hate anybody, I don't know. I think she could have kept on walking on that one and be like, you know, whatever, you know, who doesn't like hate this guy? And if they don't, what the hell's wrong with them? So that's going on. This is obviously going to expand even further. This is going to get more intense as we move forward. But it was a good day to pause and just kind of remind ourselves of what exactly we're supposed to be doing in a constitutional republic. So there we have it. Other big news this week, which of course was completely overshadowed by the impeachment stuff, but should not be, was the fact that we had COP25, or there's a UN climate change summit that got underway in Madrid, and it's just this weird formation where it's a, you know, it's in Madrid, but it's like the government of Chile is the one who's running it, or blah blah blah, which is also weird because Bolsonaro got elected there and they're burning down the Amazon. So there's a whole bunch of weird stuff going on with that. But anyways, it was it got underway. And look, folks, this has got to be at the forefront of the 2020 election. And climate change is no joke. And the fact that you have a report that was released ahead of this summit, right, by the United Nations Environment Program. It's this thing, it's called the emissions gap, right? I guess it's their 10th annual report, and they look basically at the gap between the goals and where we actually are, where we need to be versus where we actually are, and has shown that, well, even though a bunch of folks signed on to the Paris Agreement, they have not met their goals. And overall, the world is in trouble, because last year there was a 1.5% increase in emissions. There were no reductions, and that is despite the fact that we are seeing some reductions going on, that we're seeing some scaling back of coal. We also saw, however, an increase in coal in some areas. We know that China has now basically edged out Europe in terms of per capita emissions. Right, so you got to remember, it's like China is like just as an aggregate is the largest emitter of greenhouse gases, right? Followed by the United States. However, per capita, right? In other words, like the emissions per person, right? The United States is still way ahead, right? So we, per person, we actually produce, we have more emissions than anyone else in the world as individual Americans, right? So we should be clear about that, even though, because China has so many more people, their overall emissions are the highest in the world, right? So there's that. But the per capita stuff is troubling when China has overtaken Europe, because it used to be U.S., Europe, and then China. And then I think U.S., Europe, China, and Japan, I think, Europe, something like this, on the per capita stuff. But what we're seeing is also China has actually outpaced the EU in terms of per capita emissions, which means that just like we saw in the U.S., right, as you have development taking place, it's based upon the extractive industries, based upon fossil fuel burning. First, smaller groups benefit, then it gets extended out to kind of other people in the country, right? Things like consumer goods, things like electricity, you know, all that kind of good stuff. Well, that's expanding in China too as well, right? So people who formerly, say, did not have electricity, let's say, now have electricity. People who did not have access to the kind of mass amount of consumer goods are now getting that access, right? So we're seeing that kind of expanding as markets within China begin to develop, and new areas of that nation are developed, and so there's more burning of fossil fuels. And that's coming despite the fact that China has one of the most robust and serious investments in alternative energies that are out there, but they're also burning a ton of coal. So, I mean, this is crisis level, folks. And I don't know how – I struggle with this a lot. When my students and I were talking about this the other day too as well, some of them are working on projects dealing with global climate change, and it's a real challenge about how you get people to pay attention, how you get people to care, and then how you actually move that to action. Because on the one hand, it can feel so overwhelming that it feels like there's nothing you can do. On the other hand, it feels like, you know, nobody really cares. And that is so tough because I worry. And, you know, look, there's a big chunk of myself, right, which is the realist in me is saying, look, we're screwed because people are not moving fast enough. And it's going to take some sort of catastrophic event in order for us to have this kind of massive shift. I hope and I pray that's not the case. All the more reason that we've got to get somebody in the White House and we've got to elect a Congress that was going to move fast on climate change. Will the U.S. Making a concerted effort to kind of start using renewables, will that be the thing that turns everything around? I don't know. It's certainly going to take it's certainly going to help to have the second largest emitter in the world make a kind of like, you know, basically a pivot, a 180 pivot. Let's go back to renewables. That'll make a huge impact. But the rest of the world's got to come along too as well. But if we could then become leaders in that and join the leadership groups that are trying to kind of change this stuff, that would be amazing. But that starts with actually getting mobilized and stopping the petty bickering garbage that goes on half the time in campaigns and keep the eyes on the prize. We got to get our eyes on policies that are actually going to prepare us for the next century. That's really where we're at. So we'll see. We'll probably have some more reports on that as more discussions happen at the Paris at COP25 in Madrid. So we shall see. Cool numbers on polling. It's been interesting. I'm both kind of intrigued by and follow the horse race stuff, the polling stuff, and also kind of take it with a grain of salt. But just an interesting movement this week. So I'll just kind of run through some numbers for you. For those of you who do pay a lot of attention to the polls. Now, I don't do so much. I check into the national numbers once in a while, but frankly, we do not elect presidents or anybody for that matter through a national vote. We do it on a state-by-state basis that awards certain delegates. So what matters is what's happening in the states. When you take a national poll, you're just asking a popularity contest. That doesn't necessarily translate in terms of what's actually happening on the ground. So if you remember, the latest Iowa polls, we saw that this was true the last time we talked on the podcast, that Pete Buttigieg has now taken a lead in the polls in Iowa and has jumped out with a 26% of people, 26% of the polls are showing that they're supporting Buttigieg. That is followed by Sanders at 18, Warren at 17, and Biden at 12. So Biden has now dropped to fourth place in Iowa, right? A place that many people thought that he absolutely needs to win. But we shall see. So, but Buttigieg being out in front and kind of holding on to that lead right now is going to be interesting. Now, remember, I mentioned this in the onset, Kamala Harris' big announcement this week was that she has dropped out of the polls. I mean, she dropped out of the presidential race. So what's going to happen to Harris's supporters, where they're going to go, who they're going to jump in, we don't know. There's been some suggestions that there's going to be some splits between that some of them will go towards Biden, some of them will go towards Warren, and some of them will go towards Bernie, that it's not just going to benefit one particular candidate. But I don't know. I think that's all pretty much conjecture at this point. But the fact that Buttigieg is still out in front is important. Sanders is kind of continues to increase right in Iowa, which is impressive too as well. New Hampshire, right? And I'm going to just run through the early states, right? Because we've get there's a whole bunch of and I'm going to talk about California in a second too as well. But just through the early states, just for the numbers, we can see where things are going to happen. February 3rd is when the Iowa polls begin. New Hampshire. Bernie is now in first place in New Hampshire at 26%, and Buttigieg is now second with 22, with Warren and Biden tied at 14%. This is a big concern for the Warren campaign. I mean, I'm disappointed, to be frank with you, to see the support for Warren to go down. I've been a kind of advocate on this podcast and elsewhere that, you know, look, I'm kind of almost agnostic when it comes to whether we have Bernie or Warren as the nominee. Right. I am in the Bernie Warren camp. And that's the way I like to see it. If push comes to shove, we'll talk about that kind of maybe in the next podcast. I could tell you where I'm at. I mean, I'll tell you this. If I talk about a policy set, one of the things that that I'm 100% kind of that would put me 100% behind Sanders, there's no doubt about it. I mean, in terms of his policy, in terms of what I think we need to do, that's absolutely Sanders. Warren, however, I think has got some really, really, good ideas, but also knows how to work the machinery in very effective ways. And I think has a real opportunity to be effective, especially the fact that, you know, I think there's part of me that after the last election and before, and after talking with just people around me, frankly, I think it's time we elect a woman. And I think that would be a huge benefit for the country, right? I'm not just talking strategically, politically, but I think that that alone will have an impact in rallying people behind her. Yes, it's going to have a bunch of backlash, but I think it can help us turn the corner about where we need to go. But anyway, so that's kind of where I sit on those things. But policy set, certainly, I'm right with Sanders. This becomes kind of really important where Warren has fallen a bit. Some people have suggested that that's because of her wavering on Medicare for All, and I tend to kind of buy that. Maybe not because of, like, she's not a pure ideologist. I don't think that's the issue. I think it more is like, you know, people start questioning what she's doing, why she's being cagey about this thing, and why she's not answering questions directly. You've heard me talk about that in the podcast before. I thought that was going to hurt her for a while, and I think this is starting to bear out. That might just be a temporary thing, and we shall see a rebound. So we'll keep our eyes on that. In Nevada, you have Biden still ahead with 24, but that the gap is closing there. You got Bernie and Warren both at 18%, right? So you're talking about within striking distance there, especially if you can imagine if Iowa and New Hampshire go to Sanders, right? Or at least one of them goes to Sanders, or when Sanders or Warren puts in a good show and Biden just blows up. I can't imagine Biden holds on the lead in Nevada. Finally, in South Carolina seems to be the one place where you've got a strong Biden contingent. Biden is still polling at 33% there. He's 20% ahead of Warren, which comes in next at 13%. Sanders at 11, and Buttigieg way behind in 6%. Everyone else is really kind of not on the map for the most part. So that's interesting. But we shall see what happens with South Carolina as things move forward. I think that as we get closer to the South Carolina primary, some of Biden's really troubling positions on race are actually going to start becoming more prominent in the campaign. I think that people are going to start questioning his ability to win. That seems to be still one of the primary concerns among Democrats is, can they beat Trump? And his continued poor showing and his lashing out at supporters and Democrats seems to be causing some problems and a bunch of people questioning him. However, Mayor Bloomberg, by the way, is still not showing up at the polls, so we'll see. Although I've had a couple people that you know I know and love and respect basically say that they're looking at they're looking at Bloomberg, and I'm like, "Are you crazy? What are you talking about? You can't do that." But whatever. So we shall see. Anyways, that's a quick wrap up of where we've been this week. There's a lot more news that happened this week, and stuff that I would love to talk more about, but I'm just going to keep it shorter today so that we can kind of pick this all up next week when Sean is back around, when he gets back up from his train ride, which would be pretty cool. The one thing I do want to point out is that if you get a chance, American Prospect, and I believe that's prospect.org. Let me look that up right now while I'm talking about it. American Prospect basically has their new issue just came out. That's me typing. America Prospect Magazine, that is not it. Let me get it here. Prospect.org. Yep, just that is Prospect.org. Their brand new issue just came out, just came in the mail at my house. Yes, I do subscribe to the print edition too as well, because I think it's important that you support independent journalism. Hint, hint. That's right, folks. You can go to patreon.com/RC Press and become a member of Raging Chicken Press. I do think it's absolutely critical that you support independent journalism, especially these ones that are doing great stuff. David Dan, since he's taken over as a co-editor of American Prospect, has really pushed this magazine forward to where we need to go. The latest issue of the American Prospect is called Green New Deal, The Urgent Realism of Radical Change. It is excellent. I am about halfway through. I've made it through. I would strongly, strongly, strongly recommend that people pick it up. It's all on the Green New Deal. I'm sorry, the title I just gave you is the title of Robert Kuttner's opening piece on that, about Green New Deal. But it's got a piece in there by Jeffrey Sachs, Getting to a Carbon-Free Economy, by Dreamers with Shovels, looking back at the first New Deal and how that remade America. That's a piece by Nelson Lichtenstein. Got another great piece in there by David Dayan himself. And, you know, just it's his great stuff. The other thing I'd like to just point your direction to, if you look at David Dayan's pieces, too, in that issue and online at prospect.org, he's got some great pieces in there about the importance of supporting independent journalism that I urge you to take a look at, because I think as we approach this holiday season, and it is the giving season, I'm going to be doing a strong push to try to get us in shape for 2020 as we kind of reposition ourselves a little bit, kind of moving into the election year. So that is that. And with that, when we come back after the break, that's precisely what I want to talk about. New directions for Raging Chicken in 2020. Soliciting your input and your ideas, right? That'll be me after we come after the break. So I want to remind everybody, go to Raging Chicken Press. I'm sorry. Go to patreon.com/RC Press and become a member for as little as $5 a month. That's patreon.com/RC Press today, and help support Movement Media. We'll be right back.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1897. London became the world's first city to license motorized taxicabs. More than a century later, cab service has seen many changes. Today's taxi drivers are an important sector of workers trying to win union recognition. The National Taxi Workers Alliance organized in 2014 in New York City. It is affiliated with the AFL-CIO. Traditionally, each taxicab driver in the U.S. has been classified as an independent contractor. This means that a taxi driver union could not appeal to the National Labor Relations Board for recognition of its right to represent workers. But this didn't stop the determined taxicab driver. They organize their union anyway. Being a cab driver is extremely difficult. Workers are often on the streets for long hours a day, 6, sometimes 7 days a week. The U.S. Department of Labor labels taxi driving as one of the country's most dangerous professions. Taxi workers are forced to buy the fuel that they use and pay high lease rates for their vehicles. Most taxi workers also must lease medallions, which are the permits required for cabbies to pick up passengers. As independent contractors, the taxi workers are on their own to buy health insurance. Jamal Hussein, a National Taxi Worker Alliance member and taxi worker, said, "All the risk is ours. If gas prices rise, we earn less. If it's a slow day, we earn less. But the company gets its money no matter what." Taxi drivers now have to deal with the growth of ride-sharing services such as Uber. These ride-sharing services do not have to meet the same regulations and safety requirements as taxi drivers. Organizing drives have spread to other cities. In Chicago, AFSCME has helped to lead a series of cab driver actions. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to Raging Chicken's Out the Coop podcast. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. I am without Sean Kitchen this week. Sean is riding the rails of Amtrak, fulfilling a childhood dream. And hopefully that will be a merry early Christmas for him, and that the he will stave off the Grinch this year. So, yeah, so like I said, for the Pennsylvania focus this week, we're just going to kind of punt that to next week, because I want Sean to be here on this. There's a bunch of really kind of important things that are going on right now. Sean and I talked yesterday and decided, well, let's wait until next week to talk about it, because frankly, he's much closer to where to what's going on. Some of the things that are going on, some of the stuff that's absolutely hilarious, some of the stuff that is deadly serious. And so when we'll just come back and do a recap of that next week. I think he's going to have a lot of other ideas and things for us to talk about next week as well. So what I wanted to do in their second segment today is just to talk about some new directions for Raging Chicken in 2020. You know, if you've been a longtime listener of the show, you've been hearing me hinting about this for a while. And look, I'm just going to be absolutely honest with you, is that I've been struggling with like the next step? Like, where do we go from here? And I've been struggling for a couple reasons. Let me be frank with you. Sean and I have basically been the motors of Raging Chicken Press. Okay. We started, there was three of us that started out. It used to be, myself, Sean, and Wendy, who wrote on fracking stuff. Wendy up at Bloomsburg, and Wendy Lee, and she wrote on fracking. She's still doing stuff there. And she did a bunch of stuff on fracking. Sean was, involved with, the Occupy movement. This was back in, 2011. This is when, Raging Chicken launched. And, Sean, I got to see Sean grow, like, as a writer, as an activist, you know, been able to see him helping him kind of find his way to Harrisburg to do a short stint at the Rick Smith Show, which then became a launching pad for him to get more involved with some kind of local politics, where his writing really took off and he was able to really establish himself as, you know, a kind of a different kind of writer, a different kind of journalist in Harrisburg that was interested in the kind of, you know, muckraking spirit of journalism. And as part of that, he's also built a pretty kind of solid core of people around him in Harrisburg and built up respect. And, you know, one of the things that we used to get, people used to, in part make fun of us at, they used to kind of like, you know, dismiss us at, was because, you know, our name, like Raging Chicken, right? People are like, well, what's that? That's not serious, blah, blah, blah. And we always kind of took that as a badge of honor and also a certain kind of challenge, right? With the idea that you can do activist media in a principled way that has an impact despite a name like Raging Chicken, right? And as a reminder, just as the bit of history, for those of you who, you know, weren't around when we were first starting it and first starting this podcast or haven't kind of looked at our about page and stuff, that name Raging Chicken is really captures some of the motivating factors behind why we started Raging Chicken Press, right? In the wake of the Tea Party victory in 2010 and then, you know, the all-out assault on the public sector that we saw in Wisconsin, right as soon as, you know, the Tea Party folks took office up there in Wisconsin, where we saw, just an assault on public sector unions, an assault on higher education, a gutting of the safety net for poor folks. I mean, a whole bunch of stuff that was taking place. We saw it coming our way, and, you know, I figured out we're going to have a way of doing it. And there's one of the things that became starkly clear is that there was this enormous gap, right? There are some amazing national publications, progressive publications, that do great journalism, that do great writing, places like The Nation, like I was mentioning, The American Prospect, like Mother Jones, right? And all these stuff, and they do really great work. Right. And the list goes on. Right. And there's even emergent ones like The Intercept, for example, does phenomenal work. Just places like Inside Climate News, which is this phenomenal kind of investigative reporting on climate issues, places like this. Right. But there's like next to nothing at the state level. Right. There's next to nothing at the local level when it comes to kind of adversarial journalism, advocacy journalism of activist media, right? And so if I was someone like Sean at that time, right? So if go back in 2011 when Sean shows up, like, you know, my doorstep, so to speak, outside my office door and introduces himself and we start talking about what we can do. For someone like him and other people interested in kind of like this kind of work, right? The kind of media end of activism and movement building. Where does one go to cut their teeth, right? Where do they get practice, right? And, you know, for a long time, I think the center left, the center to left and you know, that whole spectrum, we relied a lot on institutional journalism and institutions like higher education, for example, and they filled a certain gap. So as activists, we would attempt to break through into that media, whether it's local media or national media, but really kind of local, like in our local areas, our student newspapers, our local newspapers and regional newspapers and so on. But what we were kind of, I think, asleep at the wheel of, and I definitely include myself in this, I was definitely not paying attention to this as it was happening, is that, you know, the slow gutting of local media, especially investigative wings, especially in newsrooms, has left this
enormous gap, right? And frankly, I don't think the internet was helpful in this on this score initially, right? Because what was happening was, instead of saying, hey, look, we got a problem here with what's happening in the newsrooms, you know, because when Reagan deregulated the media and then Clinton comes around and basically, you know, guts the FCC, and then suddenly we're finding out this mass consolidations of newsrooms. We're having like long term, like family owned newspapers handed over to the stock market, which then was interested in extracting profit from the newsrooms and therefore getting rid of its most expensive employees, which were investigative journalists. Right. And the shrinking of newsrooms. I think on the one hand, a lot of us, and again, I include myself in this, saw like the internet, you know, just by itself as an agentless thing, right, was having this impact on us. And that was the cause, right? You know, and so it was happening, this kind of natural thing. But on the flip side of it, there were some right around, you know, the turn of the 20th century or 21st century. There were a lot of, say, people that saw the need and wanted to fill the gap. And that's when, you know, we had the rise of the blogosphere, right? Where blogs became a thing, where people were doing this individual, independent kind of media or small group media, kind of what we do at Raging Chicken. And like, I don't know, blowing things up, like, you know, coming up amazing reports, amazing journalism, all this kind of stuff. But, and that was, 'cause see, like, there's this ethic of like, we can do it ourselves, right? There's this punk rock ethic, which I totally like was like there with, right? But the problem with that, right, over the years is like, it's not sustainable, right? It depends upon your will. There's no money involved with that, right? And then slowly, as people started realizing, well, wait a minute, I'm no longer in college and I have to figure out a way to make a living. How do I turn a blog into something that is going to sustain me? Right. And more of us who have turned to this kind of independent media space, right, have been doing this as like second, third jobs. And that is not a sustainable, like, process for sustaining democratic social movements, right? For progressive social movements, for expanding the involvement of everyday people and raising their voices and bring them into the tables of power, right? Media is so critical for that. And that's what Raging Chicken was. And so when I was posing that question about, look, we got these great national... this great national media, but there's nothing here. What do we do? And that's where Raging Chick was meant to fill the gap. And I wanted something, a name that was going to capture the fact that this is not something that is going to be like the progressive media, blah, 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 blah. I wanted to have a local marker, like a regional marker. And the clock tower at Kutztown University, the university where I teach, when you look at it from an angle, it looks like an angry chicken. And you can see it from Route 22. Right. It's kind of an iconic part of the Kutztown campus. And the fact that you could see it from Route 222, I'm sorry. I thought, you know what? That's a great idea. Like, I'm going to take instead of the angry chicken, I'm going to make it a raging chicken. Right. Even angrier, because we need to kind of get moving. Right. And the initial slogan was, you know, if you're not angry, you're not paying attention. Right. Kind of borrowing from back in the 1960s. And that was kind of the idea. So that's where the name came from. So, you know, we're going to stick with this because we're trying to do something different here. Yes, we're trying to do progressive media, but we're also trying to set up a space where aspiring activist journalists and media activists can cut their teeth on this work. Right. So there's this kind of like, at least as how I originally envisioned it, it was like this educational component to what we did, where I could work with some folks and then would slowly build out a cohort of people which could help bring more people into this. And, you know, the original idea was always to have people located like in the movements themselves, right? Or, you know, if I wanted, there's a movement going on in Allentown, want someone in Allentown working with those folks in order to kind of to report on that. Someone in Philadelphia reporting on that, you know, stuff like that. And we've been sometimes super successful, sometimes less successful, and able to do that. It's been really spotty, right? We had Lou Ryan, if you remember. She was with us for a while, and she's out in Pittsburgh now, and she did some reporting from Pittsburgh for a while. And that was like, we're like, oh, God, this is great, right? But look, people have jobs and they have lives, right? And Raging Chicken, as much as I would love it to be a place where I could support journalists as a primary career, you can't. Like, I mean... Basically, we're talking about an institution here that is supported by, for those of you who are members that I'm talking to right now, you are the primary supporting mechanism for Raging Chicken. The other one is yours truly, me, right? I invest personal stuff in this, right? Because I believe in this as a project, right? And that's always been the idea. And the fact is I've been very reluctant to trying to get ads and trying to get sponsors and stuff, because once you get into that game, right, you have to pay attention to that game. Right. I mean, you have to say, OK, if I'm going to take money, say, for example, from the AFL-CIO, I'm just using that as an example. Right. So, I mean, I'm a union guy. Right. AFL-CIO, that's in my camp. But the AFL-CIO, like any other organization, has got its own agenda. Right. And sometimes they don't like to be criticized. So am I going to start thinking twice about criticizing moves that happen from, their decisions that AFL-CIO makes? Right. Are they going to threaten me with my funding? This has never happened. I want to be clear, right? It's the same reason I never approached my own union, ABSCUF, right, and asked them to say, would you support Raging Chicken Press? Because I don't want to feel like, even at a small level, that I have to worry about what I'm going to say, what Sean is going to say, and report on that, right? And you've heard me kind of talk about some of the problems I have with my own union, right? And the only way that that's possible, right, is if we have a membership-driven model, right? And that's kind of where we sit, right? We have a membership-driven model that it's small, but it's been able to keep us going, right? We've been able to increase memberships and therefore pay some of our writers slightly more. That's all been going in a positive direction. Our podcast has been, I think, has gotten better and better over the years. But what's been happening of late is two things, and this is where I want to be honest with you guys. One, I mean, Sean's been doing a whole bunch of other kind of work, right? He's doing consulting work. He's doing this kind of stuff that has nothing to do with Raging Chicken, right? And that's becoming really his primary job, right? So that's the reason why you don't see Sean writing in the pages of Raging Chicken anymore, right? His other work has taken him elsewhere. And frankly, my work has gotten complicated for a bunch of reasons. And I can talk about that at length elsewhere. I'm not going to go into that here because that's not what my point of talking about it. And plus, my kids are growing up and they're involved in a bunch of other things. So I have not been contributing as much to the writing in Raging Chicken, right? So I've been focusing more on the podcast, right? As the consistent aspect of Raging Chicken Press. I don't want that to remain that way. I still want to bring on more writers. So that brings to me to go. So where do we go now? Right. I have to operate on the assumption that at some point, Sean's work is going to overtake his ability to kind of, to do stuff with Raging Chicken Press. Right. That's just my guess. Right. And that's great. I don't want to be clear about that. That's a good thing. Right. Cause, that's a good thing. So I'll continue to be reaching out. I've got some ideas about some writers. I'm actually going to be kind of looking a little bit more locally, both at Kutztown at the university, from aspiring student writers, and focusing a little bit more there. I'm going to be reaching out a little bit more directly to some organizations, specific organizations that I want to work in partnership in order to kind of develop writers that come out of their movement. Because I do think the written component is absolutely critical. I have toyed a couple times, I'll be honest with you, of just letting the writing part, right, the stories part, go by the wayside. And focus on the podcast, in part because I know I can do this and I have the time to do this and I have a schedule set up for it. But I also know that this is ephemeral, right? Whereas the writing and the reporting that you do for written pieces is absolutely critical for movements long term. So that's going to continue. So for the podcast, I've been kind of avoiding the notion that at some point Sean's no longer going to be able to do the podcast, especially if he eventually gets a job someplace where they don't want him going on, say, Raging Chicken's podcast, because it's going to put them, they don't want that as whatever to affect their brand is really what it comes down to. Believe me, people are like that. And that's going to happen. So what's going to, I'm not saying I know that's going to happen by this day. I am assuming that's going to happen at some point. So I want to, instead of getting caught unawares for it, I want to start thinking about what we can do in the podcast moving forward in 2020. And some of you may have heard some of the interviews that I've done in the past. I did some partnerships with a bookstore in Harrisburg, and they were giving me some writers that were part of their book series there. And I brought a couple of those writers on to talk to. And I want to do some more of that. Right. So I want to do some more of the interviewing, whether or not it's partnered with the bookstore in Harrisburg, but reaching out to some, say, bookstores that are in communities that have kind of reading series or something along these lines, where I'm going to be working with doing interviews with kind of writers and so on. I also want that to be a place where I'm going to be reaching out to some publications that I normally follow that are not necessarily the big name ones, but places like Labor Notes, for example, which I think is an absolutely kind of like critical publication for the movement and organization that do all sorts of great trainings and stuff like this. So I would love it if I could get, say, for example, kind of once a month having someone from Labor Notes in one of the articles and have a focus on what they're doing, having someone come on the show, talk a little bit about that. That's one of these relationships I want to kind of cultivate. The other thing is, and this is where I want to put this out to all of you, right, is that let's just assume that that at some point I want to have interviews of people. Some of them will be kind of writers, authors, right, who are writing about stuff, researchers, academics, that kind of stuff. But I also like to have people on from the movements, right? People that are doing both, say, politicians at a local, regional basis, right? Leaders of movements that you think would be really good to be on this show, right? And would benefit from having kind of an interview, right, where we could take this interview and actually kind of feed it back into the movements, right? Something to amplifying the voices and the works of people that are going on. And that's really where I need all of you, right? I don't have a kind of like a media marketing team someplace that could go out and say, hey, let's go survey all these areas, right? The best, in the best world, right? The people that are involved on the ground who are listening to this podcast know people in their communities, right? And to kind of suggest it to me, and then I can reach out to them. Or if you want to reach out to them yourselves and get back to me, that'd be great. So what I'm going to do in this and every following podcast, I'm going to have in our show notes, I'm going to have a little link where you can go and give us some suggestions about people that you would think would benefit from being on the show, that you might be interested in being on the show. I'm really wanting to focus on Pennsylvania and our region, right? So I'm not thinking there's this great book that's out there as an author. That's great too as well, but I really want to say, to put a focus on the work that is happening in our communities here in Pennsylvania and the region. So if you click on that box, it'll take you to a Google form that's just going to ask, who are you, right? Give me the name or the of the person that you think would be a good person to talk to. If you have contact information for them, that would be extraordinarily helpful. And then maybe a line or two in there about why you think they might be a good guest to have on the show, right? So keep in mind, if you're thinking about people to be good to be on the show, people who you think would also be good in this kind of format, right? Kind of in a radio format, in an audio format, in an interview format. Because there's, some people who are better at this than others, right? I mean, I've had to stumble my way through this and kind of learning equipment, learning different programs, learning how to use a mixing board, all that kind of thing. And if we can get people on that are kind of comfortable talking about their work and comfortable in this interview format, that would be kind of ideal. So this is my appeal number one to you. I'll say, yes, you're always going to hear me make the appeal. Go to patreon.com/rcpress, become a member for a little $5 a month. This appeal is really about reaching out to you and saying, hey, look, I could really use your feedback, right, and ideas about who might be good to have on some interviews. Because my semester ends, all my grading is due in about a week and a half, and then I'm going to really devote the time between now and when my next semester begins in terms of kind of setting up this next format and start to kind of secure some interviews so I can get some interviews in the can ahead of time that'll help facilitate this transition. Having said all that, Sean and I will continue doing what we're doing until we'll plan on keep on doing our kind of Friday show Out to Coop as it stands until Sean, is kind of gets another position someplace and is no longer able to do this. It might be that he's able to do it and keeps on going, which would be my preferred world, right? that Sean could decide, hey, you know what? I want to be part of just a building Raging Chicken Press. Let's invest in this, right, stuff. But, you know, that's, you know, that's my dream, whatever, not necessarily anybody else's. So we can, he can, you know, so it might just be the case where we keep on doing our regular show every Friday, and these interviews and this discussions and the kind of added content ends up being in addition to, right? So building out the podcast even more. And that would be my ideal world. At the very least, begin to kind of have making sure we got enough content to bring some other people in. That's number one. Number two, here's my other ask, right? So if there's any of you out there, right, who also do your podcast, do a podcast, or who would be interested in, being a guest on the show, I'd love to hear that too as well. I think it'd be really smart if other smaller podcasts, progressive podcasts, left podcasts, if we begin finding ways of reinforcing and supporting each other. And that might be, say, for example, once a month, having a podcast roundtable, right? That, say, for example, say there's three podcasts, right, that are doing left work here in Pennsylvania. If we did a once a month podcast roundtable, progressive podcast roundtable, whatever the hell we want to call it, and then all of us can take that content, right, and repost it on our own podcast, right? So we're basically amplifying the work that we do. At the same time, we're creating a certain kind of mutual aid society among podcasters here in Pennsylvania that are doing progressive left work. All right. So if you know of podcasts, or if you host a podcast currently that is doing progressive or left work in Pennsylvania, there's, on that same form, right, that I was just talking about, that Google form that will be linked in every single podcast description now from here going forward, click on that and send in that information too as well, and we'll be in touch. Because I would absolutely love if we can build that out. So see there. So that's where I'm having it. So last thing I'll have to say about a new directions going forward. You've noticed our membership now is we've gone through three different membership platforms. We started out with PayPal. We moved through the Podbean membership one. And now we're kind of over on Patreon. So we still got people in all those three different places. But what Patreon enables us to do is actually to kind of post content there. So what I'm going to also do, this kind of discussion I'm having with you right now, and some kind of behind the scenes stuff, and just kind of more kind of elaborate stuff, maybe some fun things. I'm playing around a little bit with doing some, I don't know, maybe a monthly, just kind of sit down at free will, where I'm just kind of talking to folks that are there, about different beers they like and things like that. It's just stuff like that. That's a little bit kind of a little bit outside the realm of Out the Coop, or maybe a little behind the scenesy or that kind of thing. And doing some members only content, to post up on Patreon, right. That will be available for members first, and then kind of later on down the road we'll release it for everyone else. But so the idea is that, you know, look, you've been a member of the show, if you've joined and gone to patreon.com/rcpress and become a member for as little as $5 a month, I mean, there's been those of you who have been supporting us since we began this show, this would be some ways to start giving back to our members. And I'm also going to do some stuff on Patreon. There'll be members only stuff where I'm going to be soliciting more feedback and kind of thoughts about things. The first thing that I will have as something that's going to be for members only, that will be our members only stuff released first, and then it'll be later more widely, is that we're probably going to have at least one, maybe two shows in the next month or so that we're not going to be able to do because of, you know, holidays and all that other kind of stuff. So what I would love to be able to do is to get your suggestions for, say, what you think were the best shows of the year. So for those of you who are diehard Out to Coop followers who listen every week, or those of you who just kind of like tuned in or heard about certain ones and like them, send us a link. If you go to our members only site first for this week, for members only, if you've got ideas what you think were some of the best shows and why they were the best shows, that's going to be going up on Patreon for our members only first, and then it will go up for everyone else kind of after that. So if you've got ideas and content, I'd love to hear what your ideas are, and we're going to try to maybe put together a little end of the year mix too as well. Anyways, all right. So that's what I got to say. That's my kind of ideas looking forward, new directions for 2020. I hope that there'll be some of you who are going to get back to me with ideas for guests, people to interview, members of the community that might be good in terms of co-hosts, people who are doing podcasting would want to say build out a podcasting network here in Pennsylvania, or at least doing kind of like a once a week kind of roundtable where we can actually all post that on all our shows. And look, my idea here is that I'm not looking for people who are necessarily like in lockstep on agreement and everything. And that's part of the richness of this kind of environment, right? We could do stuff that's going to reflect our own perspectives and thoughts on things, right? That all kind of encompass a broad kind of left progressive perspective. So that's kind of the ideas. All right. So this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We're going to come back right after this with our quick last call. We'll see you in a minute.
For the last call.
This is Kev Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. For the past 7 years, Raging Chicken Press has brought pull no punches, progressive reporting, and commentary to the interwebs. Our long-form investigative pieces, stories that no access journalist wants to touch, or rollicking weekly podcasts strive to advance progressive movements and perspectives rooted in the struggles happening across the country or down the street. We've broken national stories and caused our share of discomfort in the halls of power. If we want a progressive future, we need progressive media. And you can help support Pull No Punches, homegrown progressive media today. Become a member of Raging Chicken Press for as little as $5 a month. Simply go to patreon.com/rcpress and choose your membership level. We need to make sure to keep the movement in the media and the media in the movement. Best way you can do that is to become a member of Raging Chicken today by going to patreon.com/rcpress. Thank you for your energy, your encouragement, and your support. Keep up the fight.
Raging Chickens, Out the Coop podcast. It's our last call. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, is where we talk about space news, beer news, and anything else that's going on.
Yes, got to say, we don't have a whole lot of space news, although I have one little kind of, it's more like an update, something we talked about on our last podcast 2 weeks ago. So if you remember, 2 weeks ago, Tesla basically released its new Cybertruck, right? And the thing was like nothing you've ever seen, looked like something that was out of like some sort of cyberpunk fantasy or some kind of sketches of some 13-year-old like hanging out in junior high, like in the back of the classroom, like, oh, this is what it's going to look like in the future, man, right? All that. And that is all true, right? Absolutely. The thing is crazy. It's all angular. It looks like something that is designed for a movie set. It was something else. And it had a kind of a bit of a mixed rollout, right? So it's come out with So it's made out of stainless steel. It's made out of the rolled stainless steel, the same stuff that the some of its rockets are made out of. This new Starship is basically made out of that shiny stainless steel. So super strong. You had a guy come out, right? One of the engineers come out and hit the thing, a door of like an F-150, and put a huge dent in it, you know, with a sledgehammer, put a huge dent in it, hit the side of the Cybertruck, and nothing happened, right? Well, it turns out something actually did happen. They find out later, because when they went to show how strong their new armored windows were, and he threw basically a large steel ball bearing like at the window, it cracked the window, or two windows, actually. And they found out later it was because like when he hit the door, it actually broke broke some of the glass or some of the fairings, whatever, underneath there, which caused it to weaken or whatever it might be. So anyways, there was that kind of stuff. And, you know, the stock of Tesla dropped shortly after it. Say, what the hell is this? There was a whole lot of critics and what was going to happen. So whatever. And I believe, I'll have to go back and listen to the tape, but I believe I was kind of like, well, I don't know. We're going to see, because I think that, you know, people are saying this is going to tank. But there's going to be diehard folks, Tesla folks, who are going to want this. And we're going to actually see what happens here. Well, it turns out Tesla has done no advertising, right? They have had no paid endorsements of this or anything. They just did that one big rollout of this here. And then they opened up to orders. And already, right, Tesla has over 200,000 deposits for the Cybertruck. 200,000. Right? That is pretty unbelievable. And so remember, and part of this is because you can get basically the entry-level Cybertruck, Tesla Cybertruck, when that gets about a 250 miles of range. That's rear-wheel drive only, okay? So that's 250 miles of range. You can go up to a dual-motor all-wheel drive that gets about 300 miles worth of range, right, and so on. But here's the key, right? The baseline, the base level, get 250 miles on one charge, right? That is selling for $39,900, okay? And the 300-mile range all-wheel drive one is selling for $49,900, right? That is all before any of the incentives for, you know, buying an electrical vehicle. That does not include kind of tax rebates and all that other kind of stuff. That's impressive, right? So $200,000 in deposits, right? What does that mean for Tesla? That means that they basically just added about $20 million to their bank account for people that want the Cybertruck. And that's amazing. And as you know, Tesla is the kind of organization that they do not rarely ever meet the production goals. They're always delayed, all this kind of stuff. Despite all that, 200,000 people are already ordering this thing. That's incredible. And it's coming in at a price point that is like affordable for people who would buy these kind of trucks. Right? You go off and look at like what a Ford One F50 cost, right? You know, the best-selling pickup truck in history, right? That's, you know, you're talking about kind of within range here, right? I'm just trying to see if I can look up the price, right? Real quick of a Ford F-150. So Ford F-150 baseline is going to come around $30,000, right? So you're talking about $9,000 more, right, for a kind of state-of-the-art electric vehicle. That is not crazy pricing, right? It's still expensive to your average everyday person, absolutely, but it's not crazy. And if you look at people who are buying, say, for example, like a Ford like F-250, right, you know, looking for that kind of stuff, then you're talking about, you know, $35,000 or so for an F-250. And so on. So you're in the same kind of price range. Plus, it has a huge cargo bay and amazing clearance and super tough and doesn't cost any gas. That's wild. So, anyways, if you really want to go like all the way, you can go. There's a tri-motor one, right? That has this is crazy. The top one, the all-wheel drive one, it basically has a 500 miles of range, and that comes in at $69,000. So that's $70,000 truck. So anyways, that's just kind of interesting. So you may be able to see the Cybertruck like on your streets, like within your lifetime. Right? So that's just pretty crazy. That's my only update in that whole vein of space news and stuff. So the real news we want to focus on then today is really what's happened at Free Will this week. In Free Will on Sunday, that will be Sunday the 8th, is going to be the annual Freeze Up 5K. And that is kind of like a collaboration between the Perky Woman Watershed Conservancy and Free Will Brewing Company. This is the second time they've done it. It's called the Freeze Up 3K. I believe it starts at the brewery and it kind of winds through the trails in Perkasy along the east branch of the Perky Woman Creek. And then runners and walkers. So you don't have to run it. You can walk it. They get a long sleeve tee with the registration and can get a free craft beer at the end of the race, obviously, if you're 21. Right. So that's pretty cool. There's a link in the show notes. You want to check out more about that for Sunday. Another event Free Will has coming up the next night on Monday. That'll be Monday the 9th. Monday the 9th, Free Will has its annual tap room tree lighting. That is at the brewery in Perkasy, right in the tap room. Got this big Christmas tree. The event begins at 7 p.m. They're also going to have a food truck is going to be parked out front. The tray locally sourced. We have amazing food. You can go at 7 p.m., go and kind of enjoy it. They usually have these huge bottles of sours that they're going to pop it open and have their annual sour toast kind of ringing in the new year and celebrating the holiday season. A huge bottle will come out. They'll pop it out. They'll kind of be part of the celebration. They've not released what it's going to be. They're going to keep it a surprise until the last minute. They're also going to curate a special draft list with some of the holiday favorites that will be there. So it should be kind of a good evening. And then if you do, you show up for that, and you can actually stick around and watch the Eagles Monday Night Football game after the official tree lighting ceremonies at the brewery for that's there. And if you're in Percosy, you're going to decide you're just going to make it a weekend. You're going to go to the 5K. Why not on Saturday night? You can just come out to the Percosy tree lighting, and that is right in the kind of heart of Percosy, right next to the brand new coffee shop that is opening called the Rise and Grind. That is the former site of it's hard even for me to say, Down Earth Cafe and the Breadbox Bakery, which I loved. But the new coffee shop is opening up there. They're going to do a soft opening on Saturday, I believe at 5 p.m. They're going to have some coffee and cookies and hot chocolate. They're also going to have they'll be part of the tree lighting, and that's when like Santa comes in on the fire truck and they light the big tree in Percosy. That'll happen around 7, I think, or something like that. So all good fun this weekend in where I live, my neck of the woods. So check it out. Free Will. I also want to kind of plug some of Free Will's. They have got a bunch of releases. They got three releases happening this weekend. That would be tomorrow, Saturday. First is called Lord Business. Now, Lord Business, this is a favorite. It's fantastic. I love this. It is a West Coast style IPA brewed or hopped to the heavens with Citra, Simcoe, Chinook, Columbus, and Calypso. It's just a fantastic beer. It comes in at 8.9 ABV. So that's something that is not like brand new to lovers of Free Will. The second release is coming out tomorrow. Is the first ever done. It's called Corn Haze, right? That is a hazy IPA. It's a collab with people from White Labs Yeast. And I'm just going to read you the description here. It's brewed with flake oats and Deer Creek Malthouse malted bloof corn, fermented with White Labs unique coastal haze yeast strain, and hopped with Galaxy, Rakow, and Motuka. I got notes of pineapple, mango, apricot, and grapefruit pith. And that comes in about 7%. That looks really interesting. I don't know if I've ever had a beer that has been malted with blue corn. So that's going to be cool. It's got a nice design on the can, too, as well. So that's cool. And the final release is going to be the return of Vanilla COB. Yes, COB is the coffee oatmeal brown ale. And this one has with bourbon Madagascar vanilla. That should be really good. I remember last year, I think I liked the vanilla COB better than the regular COB. This year's COB was pretty damn good. So we shall see. I'll give you the readout of them. They brew that one with flaked oats and a variety of specialty dark malts, 60 pounds of fresh roasted Speakeasy Coffee Company coffee, and a light addition of vanilla. The vanilla rounds out the profound coffee notes and typically found in this beer. That comes in an ABV of 8.3%. So there's the three releases from Free Will. I have to say, I was able to stop by Free Will yesterday. And they remember Black Friday, they released all sorts of Ralphius and Ella. And remember, Ralphius is their Imperial Stout, aged in bourbon barrels, which is by itself, just the Ralphius is absolutely freaking fantastic. But they released like Ralphius S'mores. They released Ralphius with like, you know, cherries. They had an Ella, which is the brown ale, right? Which is it's a Belgian quad, right? Aged in apple brandy barrels. They had a black currant Ella, which I did get one of those. They had a vanilla Ella, I think. Just absolutely amazing. I'm looking forward. My favorite one that I picked up, I shouldn't say favorite one yet because I haven't tried it, but there's a spicy cherry Ralphius that looks awesome, which has cherries, orange zest, cayenne pepper, and black pepper. That is like right up my alley. They still had some bottles of that yesterday. So if you're going to head to Free Will to pick up one of their new releases tomorrow, then you should be grabbing a few of their bottles of Ralphius and or Ella. I didn't see any of the big bomber bottles left, but there were the small bottles that were there. Believe me, trust me, it is worth every penny that you will pay for them. So very good stuff. So last thing to round out. So just little last things about my kind of trip down to Florida. Yes, it was really awesome. Universal, I have to say, between Universal and Disney, we stayed at a hotel at Universal, and Universal, the Universal Studios was pretty freaking awesome. The Harry Potter world, especially, was just it was amazing. And you know, some of the rides, if you're a big ride fan, it's gonna be like any one of these big amusement parks. If you actually want to go, you're gonna have to wait a long time to go on rides. The Harry Potter stuff, it was funny. My kids were not all that kind of gung-ho about going on all the rides. That wasn't their main kind of a, like, you know, focus. It really wasn't kind of walking around in the Harry Potter world. And you could get these, you know, quote-unquote magic wands that you could walk to different places within the, you know, the Harry Potter place, what do you call it? Diagon Alley, right? It's a Diagon Alley. I should be saying it from the beginning. Diagon Alley, and you go, and there's these little kind of medallions on the embedded in the brick with these different strokes, right, that you can do with your wand. And you kind of point it forward and you do the stroke. And if you do the stroke right, something happens, right? So sometimes like smoke comes out, or sometimes like a shrunken head begins to talk, or a wall opens. You know, just really cool stuff. And they love that more than anything else. Even the stores, like where in Disney, it seems like everything was driving you just to buy more shit. And everyone that was like walking around, like had like Disney apparel on, right? Like that was the thing. It felt everything was about consumption at Disney. And I'm not saying Universal, there was no consumption there. Don't get me wrong, please. But it had a different character to it. So you went in, for example, you go down this one part where there's like a dark art shop. And they have, like, you know, some of the, you know, like a sweatshirt where you can get with kind of dark art symbols or something like this. But they also had like all sorts of really cool skulls, like crystal skulls and like stone skulls, and that you could actually buy, like things that you might actually see. And if there was a dark art shop, things that would be in there. Some of the stuff there was for sale, some of it was not. So you could go in and kind of have an experience without buying anything there, just by kind of like walking around the store and talking to some of the people who were there and kind of in character and stuff. That was an absolute blast. But, you know, most of all, the biggest thing that was the greatest part about it was just kind of like, you know, it was just my wife and my two kids and I there. And we just kind of got to spend time together and relax, just kind of swimming in a pool. We also went to Volcano Bay. I can't believe it. I didn't mention that. Volcano Bay is like their big water park. And we stayed at the hotel that was right next to the water park. And you literally walk. It's like a 3-minute walk, less than that probably, to the quote unquote secret entrance. To Volcano Bay, and that's like all these water rides. This is great, like rapids, like kind of one of those lazy rivers, except with rapids, right? They went a long way. Some the rafting rides, water rides, and these giant wave pools. It was a lot of fun. So, if I had put my money on it, if we ever decide to go again, I would strongly, you know, I'm going to advocate for Universal. I think everyone else in our families agrees to that too as well. and Disney was out. Disney part, we did go to the Star Wars world. We did ride the Smuggler's Run. That's the Millennium Falcon ride. We were not there, obviously, for the opening of the new ride, which is called Rise of the Resistance. That opened on the 5th. but the Star Wars world is really cool to walk through, right? They did an amazing job, and just in terms of like putting you in that space. My only issue with it was I don't want to say letdown, because I don't think I was all worked up about it, but it was more like less enjoyable than it could have been. When we went there the first time, it was mobbed. You could barely, you know, you couldn't really pay attention to stuff. And even the stores there, unlike what we saw in Harry Potter, and I think I kind of ruined myself after seeing the Harry Potter stuff, when we went to the droid store in the Star Wars world, it felt just like a Disney store in a different environment, right? It felt kind of like that, right? Not quite so, but that's the way it felt. So it didn't have that same kind of sense of experience. There were some cool people in character. A lot of other folks were not. So whatever. So that's what it was. That's where we were. And it was Thanksgiving. I hope you had a happy Thanksgiving too as well. And, we're getting like closing in on the end of the year and, the Christmas season. And, I have one more week left in my semester, basically, a little bit more, but I've got a ton of grading to do, so that's about what I'm about to do right now. Actually, I have to clean the house first, because we've got some folks coming down from upstate New York, so I've got to clean the house after we just got back. I can't stand it. I'm driving you guys crazy. So anyways, please, any feedback we can give you, like again, I'm going to put those forms in the show notes. I'll put that right kind of right at the top. under the title of the show. I'll probably send out something other stuff on Facebook and probably on Twitter too as well. I encourage you to kind of your feedback, your thoughts, your input on kind of where we can go. And please do pass the word. And remember, the best way you can support what we're doing and kind of position us for 2020, become a member of Raging Chicken Press and go to patreon.com/RC Press, become a member as little as $5 a month. I can't tell you what a difference it makes. What we've been able to do has been, it's really been astonishing. And to be able to think that we're going to be able to move forward to that next level is pretty exciting, I have to say. All right, I'm going to shut my mouth. I'm going to get out of here. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Hope to see you next week. Sean should be back from his train trip and talk some more. Until then.
The list of impeachable offenses that the framers included in the Constitution shows that the essence of an impeachable offense is a president's decision to sacrifice the national interest for his own private ends. Treason, the first thing listed, lay in an individual's giving aid to a foreign enemy. That is, putting a foreign enemy's adversary's interests above the interests of the United States. Bribery occurred when an official solicited, received, or offered a personal favor or benefit to influence official action, risking that he would put his private welfare above the national interest. And high crimes and misdemeanors captured the other ways in which a high official might, as Justice Joseph Story explained, disregard public interests in the discharge of the duties of political office. Based on the evidentiary record before you, what has happened in the case today is something that I do not think we have ever seen before. A president who has doubled down on violating his oath to faithfully execute the laws and to protect and defend the Constitution. The evidence reveals a president who used the powers of his office to demand that a foreign government participate in undermining a competing candidate for the presidency.